Hello and welcome to Headlines. This is Aryeh Leibowitz. I'm going to be filling in for David Lichtenstein this week. And this week we are going to discuss a very important, timely topic that really affects each and every one of us. And I'd like to introduce the topic by saying a couple of things. First of all, about 20 years ago, when 19 years ago, when I got married, it was already widely accepted that most people, before they got married, sometimes before they started dating, would get some sort of genetic test. Usually it was through Dor Yesharim, and they would provide you with a number, and you would submit the number of yourself and the person who you potentially might marry, and they would tell you whether you're compatible or not. That system essentially helped rid the Jewish community of Tay-Sachs, and we have endless Hakaras HaTov to Dor Yesharim for taking that terrible, awful disease away from the Jewish community. As I spoke to David Lichtenstein just a few minutes ago, he said we also have tremendous Hakaras HaTov to Dor Yesharim for making genetic testing something that we talk about, something that's an issue, something that some people are aware of, that Jewish people are aware of, and there's so much suffering and pain that has been saved as a result of that. Now, where we get to today's show is the following story that happened to me about 4 or 5 years ago. About 4 or 5 years ago, I got a phone call from a Talmud of mine who's been married for a few years. Maybe it was less than 4 or 5 years ago. He had been married for a few years. He and his wife had one healthy child. She was pregnant with her second child. When they went to the doctor, the OBGYN, recommended that they get a more thorough genetic screening done so that she was recommending to all of her patients, to get a more thorough genetic screening. When they did so, they discovered that even though they had both gotten the very basic screening, anonymous screening, before they got married, they were both carriers of Tay-Sachs. Now, that is a fluke. That does not normally happen. People who get tested and are told that they're fine and that they don't have Tay-Sachs, for Tay-Sachs, are normally in the clear. This was a complete fluke, and this is not indicative of what normally happens. But what struck the Talmud called with a shaila, a twofold shaila. First, before the tests on the fetus come back, because they obviously had to test the fetus and see if that Tay-Sachs, what should he be davening for? Is he allowed to daven that the baby doesn't have Tay-Sachs if it's already determined and it's already something that's been decided in Shemayim? And the second question he had was, if it were to be discovered that the baby has Tay-Sachs, then what are the halachos of an abortion? We are going to discuss neither of those very interesting halachic shilos today. What we're going to discuss is instead what struck me right away was that the doctor recommended a more broad genetic screening and was recommending that for all of her patients. And the doctor I know very well is a frum doctor and doesn't do things without a reason. So it got me interested in this topic of a broader form of genetic screening. And for that reason, we're going to dedicate this week's show to that topic of discussion of what the value of this is. Are there any pitfalls from a halachic perspective, from a hashkafic perspective, just from a seichel hayasha perspective? So our first guest on the show tonight is Rabbi Chaim Jachter. It's a very great honor for us to have Rabbi Jachter on the show with us. For those who don't know Rabbi Jachter, if you did know him, you would know him in any one of many ways, because he is a rabbi who does many different things and all of them expertly. He is a wonderful shul rabbi, a master teacher, a respected dayan and posek, and it is a very great honor to have him on the show with us and to share with us his perspective on the issues of genetic screening. So welcome, Rabbi Jachter.
Thank you so much for your kind introduction, Rabbi Leibowitz.
Rabbi Jachter, I just want to tell you on a personal note, we've only met each other, I believe, once at a chasana. that your writings in Halacha have had such a tremendous influence on me, and I just want to give you, I gave you Hakar Satov privately, now to give you Hakar Satov publicly, that all of my Tamir Halacha Shirim are essentially a cheap imitation of your writings and your style, and I very much appreciate it and continue to enjoy all that you do. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much. Also, keep an eye out for a sefer that I just came out with Koren on Emunah called Reason to Believe, Rational Explanations of Orthodox.
Oh, that sounds very interesting. Looking forward to seeing it and learning it. We're going to discuss some issues relating to genetic screening. So let's just start with something very basic. Is genetic screening, for a couple to go through some form of genetic screening, is it halakhically required as a way of minimizing pain for other people, or is it something that's a matter of personal choice?
Rav Moshe writes in his famous tshuva about screening, which is really the focus of all the discussion of genetic screening. So his lashon is it's advisable. It says ra'oi. So it's not exactly obligatory, but it's certainly advisable, and it's the right thing to do.
The right thing. Now, is there a limit? Now, getting into more specifics, is there a limit on how much is the right thing to do? Meaning, is there a point where we know too much about a person's genes, where the element of bitachon and just trusting that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take care of you and living life in a normal way is going to be compromised in some way because we have such detailed knowledge of everything that makes up a person?
Already Rav Moshe dealt with in part when he wrote that a person could claim against screening for Tay-Sachs. He specifically was dealing with Tay-Sachs. And he says that someone could object to the violation of a pasuk that we're going to be reading 2 weeks from Shabbos in Parshas Shofim, Tamim Tiyah Im Hashem Elokecha. That we should be Tamim, just completely trusting in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Don't look out for the future. Al Tachora Akara Sidos, Rashi says. And Rav Moshe says this is totally irrelevant. If you don't want to pay attention, if you're going to ignore genetic screening, Rav Moshe writes, it's like closing to your eyes what's right in front of you right now. It's not being choker acha asidos. It's not looking into the future. So if this applies to
choker asidos, but he's speaking specifically about Tay-Sachs, if I understand correctly. There are many minor diseases and conditions that people can get tested for. I believe J-Screen tests for over 200 different diseases. Is there any point, meaning eye color or any point where we get to the point where we say it's just too much, we don't need to know everything?
That's already a good question. It's an excellent question. My personal inclination feel is that a person should know the information. I don't see the downside of knowing the information. The only downside is if that somebody abuses it. And looking for a perfect match, a perfect shidduch. A perfect shidduch doesn't exist. A perfect person doesn't exist. Only HaKadosh Baruch Hu is perfect. And with certain things, the person has to use seichel, has to use judgment, like everything else. Everything else in life is balanced. With shidduchim, there should be balance as well. But just to close your eyes and not to know something and just throw it to put in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hands without screening, it doesn't make sense to me to want to ignore.
Right. Now, one of the major differences between J-Screen and Dor Yesharim, which is the classic genetic screening that's been done for decades, is that there are many differences. J-Screen tests for over 200 things, Dor Yesharim for a much smaller panel of potential conditions, but one of the major differences in hashkafa and in approach is that Dor Yesharim is very careful to keep everything anonymous. I believe that's based on what Rav Moshe wrote in his tshuva as well,
right?
Better in theory, and J-Screen is very careful to disclose everything to the person who gets tested, just like you would in the medical community. Is there a halachic or hashkafic preference, one way or the other?
But Moshe is afraid that people are going to create this stigma if they know about this. therefore he kept it anonymous. But I think that's only applying to a community where there would be such a stigma. I think to a more educated community, the way J-Screen does it, where there wouldn't be a stigma attached, that would be totally fine. I think it depends on the person, where they're, what their inclination is. But it's very important to adopt. However you do it, the most important thing is that it's done.
Ah, okay. That genetic screening should be done, and Dar Yisharim serves their community, and J-Screen serves their community, and you feel that they're both viable options for the communities that they serve. Am I paraphrasing you correctly?
100%. If I could make a little bit of a bold suggestion on this show, that I wish there would be a swap, that in the Shevich community, Dar Yisharim is accepted, but the prenuptial agreement from Rav Avad Yosef and Rav Zalman Chaim Goldberg is not yet accepted. Then in the Man Rotrav community, the prenuptial agreement from Rav Zalman Chaim Goldberg and Rav Avad Yosef and Rav Asher Weiss is accepted, but they're not using to a great extent the Dar Yisharim. Maybe now J Screen is becoming more popular. I hope it is. There should be a swap. Just like Dar Yisharim has worked magnificently. It's worked magnificently within the more yeshivish community. And why should the modern Orthodox community not adopt it? So too.
Do you find that to be the case? That in the modern Orthodox community, people just don't do genetic screening?
Some do. Some do. But it appears to me that a lot don't.
Wow. That's very interesting. I would assume that everyone should be educated enough to realize that it's an important thing to do, and that Dar Yisharim certainly pretty much rid the world of, or certainly the Jewish world of Tesach, which is a phenomenal feat and accomplishment.
Right.
Now, speaking
well,
of...
Well, the question is, has it eradicated from the modern Orthodox community? I'm aware of a case in the modern Orthodox.
Wow. So and that's obviously so easily preventable just by getting genetic screening. Now, if I were to ask the following, you have a Talmud of yours, let's say, who has been dating a girl that he knows for a long time. They've been dating a while. And let's say in the more modern Orthodox community, as opposed to the more yeshivish community, perhaps the shiduchim happen a little more organically and less businesslike in terms of having all the ducks in a row before a couple goes out. They may have met at some event and they've been going out, and maybe they've been having a difficult time in shiduchim as it was, and now they've fallen in love and they decided that they want to get married. And they do some genetic screening, and they discover that there are some incompatibilities. What sort of incompatibility would you advise immediately to nix the shidduch, regardless, if any? And at what point would you say, you know, those diseases are not Pesach, the disease that you're incompatible for, it's a 1 in 4 chance that a child has something that's much less painful, much less heartbreaking. At what point would you say that the shidduch should continue, even if there's some incompatibility?
Try to save the shidduch as much as possible. And today there are medical options, even IVF, which is drastic, but shidduchim, you try to avoid losing a shidduch. It's so hard to make a shidduch. It's kasha zivug in Yisrael, especially people that are a little bit older. It's a difficult parsha, and I know so many people that are struggling with it. And you finally found somebody, then you certainly should you try to find some options. Pesach may be a different situation. A little bit more drastic, but even there are options with having a child through in vitro fertilization. So there are medical options, but shiduchim are very a good shidduch. Eshes chayal miyim. That's not pasha.
I would imagine that
to my mind would be a last.
I painted a very dramatic picture of them being very invested in the relationship already, and having a history together, and having difficulty in shiduchim, if it were a situation where they were less invested in the relationship, would that change your mind?
Maybe, and it depends on the seriousness of the issue. So if it's Pesach, the less serious disease, it's less serious.
It's right. So essentially, you have these two factors working against each other. You have the issue
right.
of how invested they are in the issue of the seriousness of the disease, and
right.
a competent parent and rabbi and guide should be consulted.
Yeah.
Is that fair to say?
100%. Without a doubt. Without a doubt.
Now, I had a case recently where a girl her mother had just been diagnosed with breast cancer, and Rachmana Litzlan. And one of the things that they recommend right away is to have all of the daughters tested as well. And this girl is a 20-year-old girl, and she's in Shiduchim now, and she got tested. I don't know if she asked anyone whether she should or should not get tested, but she got tested, and she has the BRCA gene, the BRCA gene, I think they call it,
right.
which significantly raises the possibility of her having breast cancer at some point in her life. And it doesn't matter. This is not an issue of screening for who she can marry, who she's compatible with. This is completely about her. And her question was, at what point does she have to disclose that to a potential shidduch? What would your feeling? Is that something you have to say before the first date, before they get engaged? Where along the line would you have to say something about that?
So my second volume of Gray Matter, I discuss, I review what the poskim say about revealing defects. And basically, there are three categories. There are major defects, which one has to reveal right away. There are minor defects that don't have to be mentioned. And there's some in the middle that one should mention if the relationship has advanced. So it would seem to me that the BRCA gene falls into the minor category. It's something that that's common. It's something that's dealt with. You deal with it. You manage with it. I don't think it's necessary to mention it at all. This is known anyway. People know. I don't think so. I think people know that it's a very common issue in the Ashkenazi community. And therefore, the person knows they're taking the risk that their partner is carrying the gene.
But at some point after they're married, obviously, because it has to be dealt with, maybe after they have a few children, they have to deal with it, right? So at that point, obviously, the husband needs to
probably,
be
included. Probably a good idea. Probably
yeah.
a good idea.
Is there anything that you think that people are unaware of about genetic testing, other than that it should be done, that you think you can educate the community on, or something that we could be doing more as Rabbanim to educate the community on, other than
sure. we should talk about it. We should talk about it, and now we get the parsha with parsha shalom tamim tiyem Hashem alokacha. That we should be mafasim. It's easy. It's inexpensive, and why would we not do it? Why, when it's been so successful for those who do it, it's a shame not.
Right. Okay. Well, Rabbi Jackson, thank you very much for your time, and thank you very much for your perspective and your expertise. It's been really wonderful talking to you, and wonderful having you on this show.
One thing I could add, Rabbi Leibowitz, which is interesting, as in our shul, in the Sephardic shul in Teaneck, Shari Ora, the Sephardic la, that we have so many Ashkenazim married to Sfaradim. It's what there is, we do the mixing of the gene pool. There's a certain advantage of these family reunion marriages where it helps a healthy mixing of the Sephardic and Ashkenazic genes.
I mean, much of our tzaros comes from the fact that so many people used to marry their first cousins and from similar families, and having a more diverse gene pool by looking to Jews from other heritages to date is not such a terrible thing, you're saying.
Right.
I hear you. Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Rabbi Schachter. We really appreciate it.
Very good. Thank you, Rabbi Leibowitz. It's a great honor.
Take care. Yeah. Our next guest is going to be Mrs. Esty Rose. Esty Rose is a geneticist who works for an organization called J-Screen. Now, I'm going to let Mrs. Rose explain what J-Screen is and in what way it differs than maybe other forms of genetic testing and what its value is to us. I just want to mention at the outset that I am not an unbiased person here. Mrs. Rose and her wonderful husband, Srilly, are members of my shul and good friends of ours, but I think we'll all benefit a great deal from what she has to say. So welcome, Mrs. Rose, to the Headlines program.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay, so let's get started. I would ask, just as a basic starting point, can you explain what J-Screen is for those of our listeners who may be unfamiliar with it, and maybe how you got involved with it, maybe a little bit about your personal background and how you got involved with it?
Yeah, sure. I guess I'll work a little backwards here. I'll start with myself. So I went to Stern College for undergrad, and when I was there, I thought I was going to be a doctor. That's just was always my plan.
You must have Jewish parents.
Yes. And one of them happens to be a doctor. So it kind of was just always in my head that that's what I was going to do. When I was at Stern, I applied for an internship at a genetics clinic at NYU, which is right down the block. So it was nice and convenient, and which is honestly the reason I took the internship. But when I got there, I was surprised to find that I was actually interested in this stuff. I met with a cancer genetic counselor who dealt with women who were dealing with BRCA mutations, which is the breast cancer gene, and I fell in love with it. I thought that this was the job for me. So after Stern, I went to Mount Sinai for graduate school, and I got my master's in genetic counseling. So I'm not a geneticist. That's an MD. I'm actually a genetic counselor, which is a master's degree.
Okay.
Yeah, so after I went to Mount Sinai, I worked at Montefiore Einstein for 8 years. And then due to different life circumstances, I shifted over to working for J-Screen. So J-Screen is a great program. We are a national non-for-profit organization, and we're based out of Emory University. So at J-Screen, we test for over 200 genetic conditions, which are most commonly found in people who are Ashkenazi, Sephardi, Mizrahi, and any other population that you can think of. So anyone from around the U.S. can get tested with us because we use state-of-the-art technology to screen on saliva samples. So you don't have to take a day off from work to go to the doctor's office to get your blood drawn. Everything could be done from home. The testing process is very simple. All you have to do is register for a testing kit on our website, pay the highly subsidized program fee, and then you receive your kit in the mail a couple of days later. Anytime we get a registration, either myself or another certified genetic counselor will review the registration and learn any information about the patient's personal history or family history as it pertains to genetics. And then once the results are in, we review those as well. And then we disclose the results to our patients either over the phone or by video conferencing.
Let's focus on that point, the disclosure of the results. Now, that was something that, as I mentioned before, when I got married 19 years ago, they didn't have, at least that J-Screen didn't exist. And when I got tested, the results were not disclosed. And the thought was that it would stigmatize a person unnecessarily if they knew that they were carriers of whatever diseases they may have. Why would disclosing the results be a better idea? Why does J-Screen choose to do that?
So I think that when you're doing genetic testing in a medical way, which is the model that we're using, right? We're out of a medical a medical department in Emory. So we're doing this in a medically responsible way. It makes sense that when a doctor orders a test, you get your results. When you go to the doctor and they take your blood pressure, they tell you if you have high or low blood pressure. When they take your cholesterol, they let you know how you're doing. So it just makes sense in a medical model to receive results when you do any kind of medical test or genetic test. I've heard what you're saying about it being a bit of a stigma to be a carrier. Somebody recently even called it a mum, which I was a little bit taken aback by. But I just want to say that it should not be a stigma for somebody to be a carrier for something. Carriers are healthy. They have no symptoms of the disease. They're never going to get the disease. You don't even know that you're a carrier unless you do genetic testing. So it's not the kind
of all diseases, aren't there some diseases where if you're a carrier that there might be minor indicators in your own life, or is that...
I could think of, off the top of my head, maybe 5 exceptions, and all of those exceptions are pretty mild anyway. So,
okay.
You know, I understand...
You, muscular dystrophy, as an example, is that something that can be screened for in advance? I know David Lichtenstein spoke to someone who has children with muscular dystrophy, and is that something that JScreen would be able to screen for in advance, or is that not on the panel?
So there are many different types of muscular dystrophy. Some of the types are on the JScreen panel because they're more common. Specifically, 1 or 2 types are much more common among Sephardi people, actually. And then there are other types that are common amongst all populations, like Duchenne muscular dystrophy. So those common ones are on the JScreen panel, but not every type of muscular dystrophy is on the panel. There are hundreds of different types.
Now, can you? What I really want to try to draw out is what JScreen brings that we didn't have before. So maybe, can you just tell the story of the founding of JScreen? Like, who started it and why?
Yeah, sure. So there is a couple down in Atlanta named Randy and Caroline Gold, and they did their genetic testing before they got married. They got the go-ahead. Everything's okay. They have 1 child. And then their 2nd child, Eden, when she was born, she wasn't looking right. You know, there seemed to be a couple of developmental delays going on. She got evaluated. It took a while till they figured it out, but eventually they figured out that she has a condition called mucolipidosis type 4, ML4. When the Golds were tested before they got married, ML4 was not on the genetic testing panel, so that's why they got the go-ahead. It turns out that both of them are carriers for this condition, and every time we have a carrier couple where both the male and the female are carriers for the same thing, there's a 25% chance, or a 1 in 4 chance, that each of their children will be affected with the condition. So with their first child, they were lucky, and their first child was unaffected with ML4. But unfortunately, with Eden, she is affected with ML4. The Golds really just took lemons and made lemonade out of their situation, and they decided that the community just doesn't know enough about this and that something had to be done. So, like I said, they live down in Atlanta, so they approached people at Emory University, and they started a smaller kind of pilot program just for the Atlanta community called the Atlanta Gene Screen. And they noticed after maybe a year or so, I wasn't there at the time, but I think it was about a year, that this is a program that could do much better on a national level, just because there are so many Jews in this country and so many people have no idea that genetic testing is recommended prior to a pregnancy, especially for Ashkenazi Jews. So they did a survey in the area, and they found that 75% of people who are of reproductive age didn't even know that this was a good idea to do before testing. That's a pretty bad number, 75%. So they realized that, no, we got to do something about this. We have to bring it to the broader community. And that's how JScreen was born.
There's the number of diseases that you mentioned that JScreen screens for, I would say tests for, but really it screens for it too, because the parents clearly don't have these diseases. It's just a question of whether they're carriers. The number is an overwhelming number. Is there some concern that only if people have this information, that people are going to start asking about any prospective shidduch not having any slight chance? You know, some of these diseases, I would imagine, are not a 1 in 4 chance, are like a 1 in 100 chance or a 1 in 1,000 chance. Is there some sort of concern that we're going to mix too many shidduchim with this kind of testing?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think to answer your question, I would say that just because you have a couple who are at increased risk because they're both carriers for things, doesn't mean that a shidduch needs to be nixed. So a lot of that will depend on a conversation that our patients have with one of the genetic counselors. Often a rabbi is kind of involved in these kind of conversations, but I think the end result will depend on how severe the condition is, what kind of treatments might be available for the condition. So it's a very case-by-case basis kind of situation where not all of the conditions are very severe, but even still, it doesn't necessarily mean that a shidduch needs to be nixed, as you said, and sometimes knowledge is power. So even if a couple will decide to go ahead and have children together, there are things that they can do to reduce the chances of having sick children. So not every couple that's found to be at high risk needs to nix a shidduch, and I think a lot of it will depend on what the condition is, what kind of a relationship this couple has already. Have they been dating for 5 years already? Have they not even met yet? You know, there's a lot of different factors that go into a decision about nixing a shidduch. And that's why at J-Screen, we would never recommend that somebody nix a shidduch from the get-go. Instead, we would recommend that they have a serious conversation with us so that they can learn their options and then make an informed decision.
Have you had Rabbanim involved in the process in the sense that either supporting the organization or after testing has been done in consultation to discuss what it means, and have you been able to educate rabbis on this issue?
Absolutely, yeah. We actually encourage people who very much want the input of their rabbis. We encourage them to speak with their rabbis. I'm happy to speak with them as well, just to educate them about exactly what the condition is, what the symptoms could be, what the treatments are, what the risks are, what different options the couple has in order to avoid having a baby with the condition. So I am very encouraging of involving rabbis in the process. You would also ask if J-Screen has rabbinic support overall, and the answer to that is absolutely. Just last year, Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman invited us to YU with his Medical Ethics Society to do a screening event. So when we were there, we screened over 1,200 students in only 3 days. So that's it was pretty groundbreaking. We broke a lot of records in those 3 days. The event was totally supported by Rabbi Willig, by Rabbi Brander. Rabbi Willig and his wife actually got tested in public. They showed everybody that they were getting tested so that he can show us, you know, how important this type of testing is. Aside from
those listeners who don't know, Rav Willig, Rav Mordechai Willig, I believe, is just celebrated his 70th birthday. So I think his past childbearing years, but probably wanted to make a statement for the Talmidim that they should see that this is a good thing to do. Is that fair to assume?
Yes, that is very fair to assume. Yeah, he wanted to make a statement, and he definitely did. They took pictures, they put it in the paper, and I'm very happy about that because Rabbi Willig is a very influential rabbi and he's very well respected. So I'm so proud of him that he did this in public, and I think it's great. Aside from him, we also have support from many other from organizations, boards of rabbis, yeshivas, rebbetzins. You know, many heads of these organizations send their own children to get tested with us. You can imagine I can't discuss their names for privacy reasons,
right,
but so many of them end up sending their own children to us. And a lot of rabbis will even require that their couples get screening before they agree to be in Seder Kedushin at weddings. I've seen that a couple of times. So,
Would you think that J-Screen is for everybody, meaning let's say in a more Hasidic community where maybe which I believe was part of the concern with Darya Sharim, and the reason that they kept things anonymous was that they were concerned that all the education in the world is not going to help people, is not going to prevent people from believing that there's some sort of stigma. Is J-Screen, is the goal to test everybody, or is this something that, you know, if you're from a more scientific bend, then this makes sense, and each community up where they're holding from their own hashkafas and their own understanding of life.
So I think that J-Screen should be done on every single person with Jewish ancestry. I really do. I understand the concerns of the more Hasidic communities about remaining anonymous, but I hope that our education to the communities and to the community leaders like the rabbis will eventually make its way to those communities and will and people in the communities will realize that it should not be a stigma to be a carrier and that they are going to be okay if they find out that they are carriers for things. So I don't think that J-Screen should be excluding any community. We should be encouraging everybody to do it. J-Screen, I believe our test is far superior to other testing panels out there. Like we mentioned before, we're screening for over 200 conditions, and many of those conditions, or most of those conditions, are not on the Dori Sharon panel. So I'll give you one example of many, but right now I happen to be dealing with a family who has a child with a condition called Walker-Warburg syndrome. For those of you who don't know, Walker-Warburg syndrome is a very, very serious genetic condition that affects brain development and eye development and muscle development as well. Babies who have this condition usually end up extremely mentally handicapped, and most of them pass away by the time they're 3 years old. One in 150 Ashkenazis is a carrier for Walker-Warburg syndrome, which is pretty common. You can easily imagine a room of 150 people, right? So one of those people would be a carrier. So that's pretty common. However, it's not on the Dori Sharon base panel. So this couple that I'm...
Is there an explanation for that?
I don't have an explanation for that, no. I am not aware of how they decide which diseases should be on a panel and which ones should not be on the panel, but I think that one in 150 is a very significant number for Ashkenazis, and it makes me upset that this
just
is not on the panel.
Give me a frame of reference. As far as Tay-Sachs is concerned, what are the numbers? It's one in how many are carriers for Tay-Sachs?
Tay-Sachs is around 1 in 30 Ashkenazi Jews. Cystic fibrosis
is
also about 1 in 25. So I personally think that anything in the 1 in 100 range is pretty common. 1 in 100, 1 in 150 is pretty common. And then aside from that, you also have to think about how severe the condition is. So at J-Screen, we employ very strict criteria to decide which diseases we should include on our testing panel and which ones should not be included. So to me, 1 in 150 with that clinical picture that I described is pretty serious, and that's why I believe that this condition should be on the panel. So this couple that I'm dealing with, they did Dori Sharon, they got the okay, and now they're dealing with this terribly sick child, and it's, you know, a lot of suffering on their family. So aside from them, all of their siblings, this child's aunts and uncle, they're all coming to J-Screen now to get tested because they did Dori Sharon because that's the right thing to do in the community for shidduch purposes. But then on top of that, they're coming to J-Screen because they know that J-Screen has a far superior panel, especially with this condition, because they know that, you know, their family has an increased risk. But I can't tell you how often I'm seeing this, where people do Dori Sharim and then come to us afterwards to get better genetic testing. So there's some kind of disconnect somewhere here, right? They should go directly to the better test. But I think in certain communities, it's not accepted in the shidduch world to not do Dori Sharim. So that's why they're doing both at this time. It's a little bit scary because Walker-Warburg is one example, but there are many more that I'm not mentioning right now that are common and very severe that are not on the Dori Sharim base panel. So
just to be clear, the goal over here is, as I was talking to an Adam Gadol Ma'od very, very recently, and you were there. You were talking, actually. I was just listening in. I don't want to reveal his name just because he didn't officially want to come out publicly saying anything. But he started the entire conversation about genetic testing by saying that the goal has to be to minimize pain and suffering, and that is the most noble goal, to minimize people's pain and suffering. It's not to besmirch any organization, especially such a great one like Dori Sharon. It's not to do anything like that. It's to minimize people's pain and suffering, and if we have a better method of doing so, so you are arguing pretty passionately and forcefully that we ought to do so in order to minimize people's pain and suffering.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I guess I should have started by saying that I have the utmost respect for Dori Sharon because they pretty much eradicated Tay-Sachs in the Ashkenazi community. Nowadays, if a baby in the United States is born with Tay-Sachs, they're usually not Jewish babies. So they have greatly influenced the community and made it normal and standard to get genetic testing, and I respect them very much so for that. I think that, I'm coming from a clinical standpoint because this is what I see. I see babies who are sick with conditions that should have been tested for, and I think that's where I get, very passionate. I think that we should be proactive about our health and not reactive. We shouldn't wait until a baby is sick for us to realize that we could be doing better testing.
Okay. Thank you very much. I really appreciate you coming on the program and enlightening us about J-Screen, and you should continue doing good work for the Jewish people.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, be well. Take care.
We have on the phone with us from New York City, Reb Nechemia Krauss, who, rather than me telling his story and introducing him, let me introduce him and let him tell you our story. Welcome, Reb Nechemia.
Hi, how are you?
Can you tell us a little bit about your story?
Share with us. Well, I got married, and I basically had two children. My first child was born approximately 3 to 3.5 years into my marriage. Since it was my first child, I didn't recognize necessarily signs that something was wrong, because you can't tell right away. He was developing slower, but again, because of our first child, we weren't as aware of it. If it was my second child, I would have realized right away, because I would have realized how a normal child develops. About when he was 10 months old, my mother sat me and my wife down. She said she thinks there's something wrong with our child. No overt signs, except he wasn't developing at the same rate. At that point, we actually started going to doctors, and we got a diagnosis that he had autism, which was kind of wrong, kind of right, as you'll see when I continue. Because of that, because we live in such a Medina Shel Chesed, he got a tremendous amount of services. My Rebbe Movik actually has a child who's autistic, so he linked us up with something called ABA, and I became a little bit of an expert in myself, and we kind of basically really saw a miraculous development in that area. But because we had so many people in the house working with him, when he was about 2.5 years old, a physical therapist, was actually Chassidei Umetz HaOlam, I'll tell you about that. He kept on pushing us that we should go back to the neurologist. He feels that something is wrong. Something else is wrong. Now, legally,
What is your child's name?
My older child's name is Yaakov Yosef.
Yaakov Yosef. After the...
No, actually, Yaakov is my grandfather, and Yosef is the Mechaber.
Okay.
And so we finally actually mentioned to him one time, we made an appointment, and he actually had lived, we were living in Passaic at that time. He went ahead and said, when is your appointment? It was Monday, and he wasn't going to be back by my house till Wednesday. He said, I'm going to drive across New Jersey on Sunday. I want to give you something to give the doctor. What he was doing, actually, of course, we had no idea at the time, was he was literally writing a textbook, basically diagnosis without actually naming it, of the symptoms, so the doctor would know where to look right away. We didn't understand that until later on, looking back at that letter. Ignorance is bliss at that point. So when we went to the doctor, we gave him the letter. He was very relaxed. He said probably nothing, but he said, let's just do some tests. And basically, then we got the phone call later on that week. I need to see you in my office right away. And I was like, well, my wife's working. And so we worked it out. And it was actually a Thursday night or a Wednesday night. It was a Thursday night. And when we got there, he told us that basically my son's CPK, which is a sign of muscle breakdown, was 42,000. In an average person, let's say, I think it ranges from 150 to 300 if they've done a lot of exercise or something like that. And something is, so that gives you a little bit of a rate of muscle breakdown versus a normal person. And basically, he described in detail, I'm not sure why, the pediatrician said a lot of people go into denial, so maybe that was his reason. He described in great detail what was going to be happening to my child. He actually told us basically by the age of 9 maximum, he's going to be in a wheelchair, and somewhere between 14 and 16, he's going to need to be on a breathing tube, and by 20, he'd basically be gone. And then he said, and you need to test your other children, because your other son very possibly has it too. I already had my second son at that time, and so we didn't test him right away because we needed time to absorb the first one. And basically, we were living in Passaic, and an opportunity opened up for us to move back to Brooklyn.
What was your and your wife's reaction when he told you that your son has muscular dystrophy?
So I look at the hashgacha of the fact that we thought my son had autism first as, you know, a little bit of, so to speak, a Kadosh Baruch Hu appearing us. Because we look back and dealing with the autism, which, again, we had dealt with it and we really got rid of, except for this, definitely always the lifelong effects. They call it more like an Asperger's, we turned it into. But, you know, so that was like a little bit of a softening up. We look back and that was almost like a joke compared to what we ended up having to deal with. Our reaction was we were totally stunned. We don't really remember anything. We entered in like a daze for a few days. I happened to have about 6 months early become very, very close friends with someone who had lost 2 children to Tay-Sachs. So he rang our doorbell on Matzah Shabbos. So this is like Thursday night, so Matzah Shabbos. We don't remember much because we didn't really move much between Thursday night and Matzah Shabbos. And that's basically, it's interesting. Me and my wife both had the same experience. That's when like our memories start again. And he just rang a doorbell and he came and he sat down. And, you know, him and his wife were, so to speak, on the other end. And just that vision of someone on the other end somehow allows a person to a certain extent to pull through it in a different way. You know, like Rav Henoch Leibowitz Zatzal says, he asks on the Gemara. The Gemara says that Hillel is Mechayev Daniyim, and it goes through a whole list of these individuals that Mechayev all these people. And he says, wait a second, if it's within the human capability, so why do I need a Hillel? If I'm obligated to learn even if I'm poor, then regardless of whether Hillel is there or not, if I'm not, because it's not within my capability, how does it help that Hillel existed? So somehow there's some kind of a dynamic within the human being that having an actual physical image, I don't know, image is not the right word, reality of someone else who's, so to speak, gone through and is pulled out, somehow allowed the person to reach into themselves and pull out capabilities that they can't do without that.
And I'm curious, did you take Dari Yisharim tests before you got married?
Oh, yeah, of course.
But Dari Yisharim doesn't test for muscular dystrophy.
No, well, first of all, Dari Yisharim only tests for things that require two parents. Again, this might have changed, but Dari Yisharim, my understanding is their policy, they only test for things that require two parents as carriers to go ahead and it to occur. Muscular dystrophy doesn't work that way. Even in my wife's family, well, first of all, there's two things about muscular dystrophy. First of all, muscular dystrophy has the highest amount of what we call a germline mutation, which means that, which is not the case with my wife, which means that a lot of times the mother herself is actually not a carrier, and somehow somewhere between 20 to 60% of her eggs mutate when she's being created by the Vayeilum, and she could actually not be a carrier, and still the situation where the children will have muscular dystrophy. But otherwise, in my wife's case, actually, it's very interesting. My wife herself is a carrier, but her mother is not and her father is not, which means my wife was being created. Her mother's eggs must have spontaneously mutated, and her mother is not a carrier, but my wife is a carrier. So you only need one person to go ahead and have this condition, so Dari Yisharim doesn't test that. That's number one. Number two, Dari Yisharim really tests for things that they've been able over time to bring down, so to speak, the cost. Like once we knew what we were looking for, we knew we were looking for muscular dystrophy, it actually costs $6,500 to find a particular mutation that we were dealing with. Now, my kids have a very, very unusual mutation in that the genes are broken down into exons and nucleotides. So most mutations are either what we call a duplication, which is an additional exon, or a deletion, which is a missing exon. And in my kid's case, one nucleotide in the body. And if you're aware, some genes have over 1 million nucleotides. One nucleotide, that's what I'm told. One nucleotide in the body is, so to speak, quote unquote, the wrong nucleotide. And basically that causes the gene to be stopped reading the rest of the gene, so the body can't put out the expression. So people that were much earlier, they would go ahead and test and they would see that the kid had muscular dystrophy, but they would do genetic testing on the exon level and they wouldn't even see, they couldn't figure out like what's going on because the gene looks fine.
And then you found out about your second son.
Right, correct.
What's his name?
His name is Shimshon Yecheskel. We really basically knew, but we didn't want to know. We needed time to observe the first one. But once you have your first one and you were told that it's a possibility, you start watching and you start seeing things. And you kind of, know. But we didn't really know definitively. But basically, when we were moving back to New York, we needed a definitive diagnosis for the services. But it was really, we really knew, because when we got back the results, we didn't even cry because we had a really, we basically knew.
Tell us what it's like living with two children who have muscular dystrophy.
So it depends really how you want to approach it. What me and my wife do is basically we do ad muckum shoddy my gas. So we basically, from the moment they were diagnosed, we became like experts. And often, in fact, High Lifeline sends new parents to me sometimes to educate them. Sometimes I tell them, don't send them to me yet. They're not ready for all the information. So we're very heavily involved in the care. So they have 45 minutes of stretching every day because that's a side effect. They take all these medications, and each medication causes other side effects. So they have a severe osteoporosis. They have literally, I think I counted up about, it's 22 sessions of therapy weekly. That's addition to I take them swimming as much as possible to get them in the pool. Also, we have the mainstream, which is itself a challenge because there are some cognitive effects. It's like a little bit of they don't fit anywhere. They need a massive amount of support to be able to manage in the mainstream. Like during the summer, I actually spend 2-3 hours teaching them every day to try to help them get through the first few months of the next year. So basically, that's essentially what life is, therapy and medicines, and they have a lot of simcha. You know, we always try to keep things very happy, and they're very known for that. They're being extremely happy. So that's really.
Are you able to work given all this?
me and my wife actually both work part time. We actually have an unusual situation, which works for us and prevents a lot of. We're both very heavily involved in all the aspects, and a lot of situations like this. One of the members of the couple ends up being totally involved in trying to manage just the financial aspects, and the other one is totally involved in the physical aspects of the care, and it becomes they can't necessarily relate over time, and each one has very, very different stresses. So in a sense, it actually works well because we're both in both worlds that way. And I really officially, the way I set up my life is I'm supposed to be learning half the day. And it depends whether I have to deal with stuff, which is very often. You're really, between all the services and all the things, you're really managing $500,000 budget of services, and it takes a lot of effort and everything involved. And you always have these things thrown at you. This week, for example, right before we got on the phone, I was dealing with the medicine I used to buy from them from England for the last 10 years for $600 a year. They approved in the United States. So now that it's legal in the United States, you can't buy it from England. And instead of $600 a year, it's $80,000 a year. So we were dealing with that. Baruch Hashem, we got it approved this week. So that's taken care of. But there's always things. My wife, at night, the amount of time she spends on the phone just dealing with managing the basic aspects of everything is unbelievable. Para gets sick, or he can't go to school that day because it's not safe because of his osteoporosis. So you have constant things thrown at you. And then, of course, you know, one of the interesting things you find out is all the regular things that happen to people still happen to you. So on top of that, you know, you still have a situation where you have a water table problem in your basement, and if it rains too much, your basement floods, and you still have someone bang into your car, and all those other things that still happen, which take people's time, you have to find the time to deal with besides for this. It's not like you're a little surprised in a sense at the beginning, like, hey, I'm dealing with this big thing, so everything else should work out, but it doesn't actually work that way.
So let me ask you a question. Do you have any other children?
Yes, I have. Thanks to Bona Yolam, I have a daughter. She's 5 years old.
And when you say thanks to Bona Yolam, they did PGD, is that it?
Yes. They actually, the story, what happened was my sister had got married, and her husband lost his mother during Shana Rishona. And what they did, unbeknownst to us, is they sent out a letter not mentioning her name, discussing her situation and asking people in Hinzecha Nishmas, his mother, to go ahead and donate money. And then when they had $20,000, they came to us and they said, here's $20,000, why don't you see what you can do? My daughter's actually named after his mother. So we had approached Bona Yolam at that point.
Well, then TGD chose eggs, basically, that are not that will not carry forward.
Well, it's not as simple as my father put it out. He said, oh, he thought once we contacted Bona Yolam, you know, and the science out there, it's a done deal. It still requires, as everything in life, a tremendous amount of miracles in Yad Dishmaya. Because what PGD does is it takes off a cell on day 3 out of 6 cells. So you first have a normal process of IVF, and, you know, itself, it's not automatic. And then when you're taking one cell off on, I think it's day three, basically you could collapse a lot of eggs. Again, the more science develops, the less the risk becomes, because they get even higher specialized lasers. But just think of yourself, if someone could cut off 1/6 of your body, even if they would try to do it in the most optimal way possible, think of what your chances of survival are, so to speak.
So let me ask you, Nehemiah, do many people have children with muscular dystrophy?
The official numbers are, I think, 1 out of every 3,500 births. I don't know what in the firm community. There's definitely, I mean, I guess the circles we run in, we know a lot of them. So, you know, that could also skew your view of reality. But there's definitely a very decent amount. And for some reason, when we were, it's actually, to me, could be anecdotal. Seems like it's increasing tremendously, because when my kids were diagnosed, I think we were like, seemed like, from what we understood, we were their first family in a few years, and just in the last few years, just constantly. I mean, my son kind of was the, so to speak, one of my sons in his school, he was the first boy with this condition there in their history, and now they have another, I think at least two, maybe even three boys with that there that are mainstreamed over there. And,
sounds like a very special school.
Yeah, but they're mainstream in different schools, but both of them work with my boys.
How do other parents that you've experienced deal with it? Like, how do they deal with the trauma? Are they able to deal with it?
It depends. It's not easy for a lot of people. The way I look at it is most pain in life is called caused by what I call kara hamaduma, which means imagination. So I remember actually the first time I was exposed to this concept was actually my friend who had lost a tooth in Tay-Sachs. He told me something which I couldn't understand at that point, but I thought about it a lot because I knew he wasn't crazy. And he said to me, if he was raised from the time he was born, that he's going to grow up, he's going to get married, have children, that he's going to take care of them as they die, as he put it, then it would have been a lot easier for him to deal with his situation. It was a shocking comment to me, and I didn't understand it until I realized over time what he was really saying is that the hardest part of how a person is going to deal with what happens to them is whether they're going to accept their reality and deal with it as their reality, or they're going to live in their imagination still. When a person lives in their imagination, it's very hard for them to move on. So, and it's, of course, a very big challenge because your whole world is completely different than you've ever imagined. So that's really, I find that has a tremendous effect on whether people deal with it one way or the other, is really, you know, that step about whether they still live in the imaginary world that's, you know, that most people get to live in a sense, to a certain extent, or they live in the reality. And that's one aspect. And the other aspect is, of course, just, you know, literally getting through the day-to-day life.
Can you tell us about some people who maybe haven't handled it so well that you know of?
Yeah, well, according to High Lifeline, the divorce rate is astronomical, which is understandable.
How high is it?
I don't know if the numbers are real, but I don't know if it's a scientific number, but I was told at least 50%. And that's, I think, in the firm world. In the Gentile world, it's much higher than that.
And why is that?
Well, because, first of all, you think of it this way. There's a lot of reasons, but I'll start it very simple. If you ask anybody who does any marriage counseling or anything, et cetera, they'll always say, oh, you have to take care of yourself first, right? But what if literally every time you even want to take care of yourself a little bit, you're doing it at the expense of your child? So then what? Right? So what if there is no such thing as a Sunday because you're literally running around from therapist to therapist? Or for example, actually the only time me and my wife get to go away is basically essentially when my kids are at Camp Simcha Special, and we really need a break because otherwise it's just too complicated to deal with everything that's involved in their care. Nobody could do it.
Do you know people who were broken by it?
Oh, of course. 100%. I mean, most people are, I think.
Define, like, what does it mean they're broken by it? What does that mean?
They look at their life as not really the life they wanted, and they look at their life as a life of suffering and rather than living. I would define, I don't know if that's a good example, but I would find someone who's broken defines that they're not living life, but they're basically, so to speak, I had an aunt, a great aunt, Halava Shalom, she used to say at the end of life, I'm pushing the days, which means they're just, so to speak, counting the days and doing what they have to do to get through, so to speak, until the end. I would call that someone who's broken. I don't know if that's a good definition, but off the top of my head.
Now, if there are tests out there that can prevent a lot of these diseases, or if there were a test out there that could, you know, before when people get married, they would say, look, you know, you have to do PGD from the beginning because you could have a child with muscular dystrophy, would you encourage parents to take it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are two shittas in halacha, so as far as I understand, but in the literature community, it's definitely the halachically viable option. There's nothing to talk about. I think, excuse the expression, but you'd have to be literally need and want to be in a mental asylum if you had opportunity and you didn't take it. If you were aware and I mean, again, like I said, I wouldn't consider myself a broken person. It's the reality. But if someone was provided with the opportunity and it existed and they were aware, so to speak, that it was an issue and they didn't take it, I don't even think that's a realistic thing. I think someone would be insane. I don't think any sane person would actually choose that. The only way someone who is sane would actually consider that a question is if they actually didn't understand the reality. That's the way I would put it.
Well, thank you very much for talking and sharing the experience. And I hope that, you know, I hope that the message reverberates with our listeners. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Zagazant.
Thank you for listening to our show this week about an issue that is so important in medicine, halacha, hashkafa, touches on so many different realms of life. I think the takeaways from our show this week are that, first of all, and most importantly, everybody should get tested or screened before getting married. It's an especially important thing to do and the responsible thing to do, and it can save so much agmas nefesh later on in life. The second thing we learned is that there are several ways to do so. Classically, we have Dar Yesharim, and more recently, J-Screen has come on the scene as a more extensive set of tests with different, and we learned a little bit about the differences between the two of them. And third, that a person should consult their doctor before getting genetic screening about the importance of it. And once you have the information that you have, one should speak to their Rav about what to do with that information as far as what's worthy of canceling a shidduch and what's not worthy of such a step and what proper steps are to proceed with caution. The goal of the show, as in many of David's recent shows, has been to try to minimize pain and suffering in the Jewish community, and hopefully by being educated about this issue, we'll help to accomplish that. So if you are a chassan or a kala, or even if you've been married for some time but are planning on having more children, you can certainly contact jscreen by jscreen.org or 404-778-8640. Filling in for David Lichtenstein, this is Aryeh Leibowitz wishing everybody a wonderful week.